Welcome to Cambridge Science on Cambridge 105 Radio and on the internet. It's a show where two people discuss things about science. One of them, a clever scientist, and the other one, a professional but maybe useful idiot. Hello, I'm Richard Reddy. My friends call me Spanners, and I would very much like it if we became friends. And my other friend is Dr. Andrew Holding, who you may have figured out is the smart one who knows things about science. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. I always love the fact you invite me as the smart one.
Well, I mean, it's all relative, isn't it? Maybe we could bring in some intellectual Goliath who would think of you as something as a dummy. So who would you know nailed on if I say, here's Derek and they do X, and you'd go, Derek's definitely smarter than me?
I mean, in Cambridge, there's quite a few people who've got Nobel Prizes, so we have a few to select from.
Oh, Nobel Prize. So if someone walks in with a Nobel Prize, you think, I feel a little dwarfed here.
So genuinely, I think it must be in the first week I was working at the MRC, Laboratory of Molecular Biology. I think it was Sean Munro, who's now one of the heads of one of the divisions, was running down the corridor because someone else there had just won the Nobel Prize.
Nice.
That was Venky for the structure of the ribosome. He's a really nice guy as well. He is very busy, but he's the kind of person who, if he had time, would come on the show like this.
Should we shoot for the moon? I think, yeah, let's have a Nobel Prize winner on here. But would that not make you feel like inferior? Would you be like, now I'm just some mug with a PhD? All I do is cure cancer. That's all I do.
Well, I haven't cured it yet. That's why I don't have a Nobel Prize, right? There's obviously multiple ways to do science, and I think there's a good number of people who would get jealous, right? There are people who are very, very competitive. And then there are people who, and I try to be this kind of person, who do the best we can, enjoy the journey, and you know, love to have that level of success.
Yeah.
But it's not, if I make that the be-all and end-all, it's a really challenging place to be under that pressure all the time. And actually, I don't think the people who have got those great awards, who have stayed nice people and have, you know, have managed their ego and stuff like that, I don't think they ever did it for that. They never expected to get that. They just worked hard. And therefore, now when you see them, they're very modest about the work. But it's because they're genuinely modest people. I don't think science is necessarily best when it's run by egos.
So it's not as competitive as, say, being a presenter.
I think the difference with being a presenter, because, you know, this is when I was working as a science person on BBC Horizon, it was the head of programming at the time turned around to me and said, you know, what you've got to remember, if you're a presenter, you are the product. And tomorrow, nobody might want that product.
Yeah.
You're done.
All right.
Whereas in science, you're not the product. Your outputs are what your currency. And yeah, of course, it's competitive. It's very competitive. You've got to justify at research funding stage that, you know, you deserve this money and you're going to make good on it. There's that kind of competition. But at the same time, there's a many different levels you get involved in it where, yeah, if you wanted to be a BBC presenter, you know, on the TV presenting science day in, day out, as we know, there are some very successful people doing, they are the product. And if their face doesn't fit, literally, that person's career will change.
It's very fickle.
Media works.
Yeah, one minute you're a beloved local gardening host, and the next you're not. So, but I don't have that thing where I can be like magnanimous. If I see what one of my peers or someone who I think that I do a better job than, and then they get that job, and I'm like, Raja Smudger, I go like Muttley from whatever that program was. What program was Muttley in?
It was a racing car one, wasn't
it?
Wacky Races.
Wacky Races, there you go. Yeah, I don't know. So maybe being a presenter isn't as important as being a scientist, so that's okay. And you'll never get me to admit that again.
Never again. But, I think there are moments where you get frustrated, and I think the thing I always have to try and remind myself is, in science, you know, it's a team activity, even if we're not working in the same team. And seeing success for science, it's great. There's always a positive where, this doesn't mean you don't go, I wish that grant came my way.
Yeah.
I wish I, you know, had that. And those feelings are genuine and you process them, obviously. But if you aims to process them in a healthy way, not in a vengeful, attacking people way. And, you know, and I think a lot of scientists got into science to do good science, right? That's why they're there. You know, there are challenges. There are times where things go wrong. We can find examples of people who have been done for misconduct. But I would like to think that's not the majority. I think most people do good science because they really believe in what they're doing.
Well, good. And we are failing to get to the subjects of today's show. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking to Nicole Thomas about dementia and the human factors around allocating funds and resources. It was a really fascinating chat, so I can't wait to play that for you guys. And then also, what's the news story we've got lined up? Oh, when babies become conscious. So I'm looking forward to that because I love that, because I'm not entirely convinced I'm fully conscious now, especially as my ongoing struggles with sleep continue. So I'm just going to keep updating this until it's cured. But obviously I was struggling with sleep, going to bed very late, essentially became nocturnal, and I was just about getting a handle on it. And then because I cover Formula One professionally, the Australian Grand Prix being moved to the middle of the night for us, 4 a.m. starts for the Grand Prix, practice sessions at 1 o'clock in the morning, I have gone completely down the drain, totally down the drain, and gone fully nocturnal again. So there was one evening, I was up editing until 1:30. The Formula One practice session started, and I've got to watch it and tweet about it and interact with people. And then there's a 2-hour gap. So I had a nap on the sofa, woke up for the qualifying session, watched that, went back to sleep again, got woken up by the kids to go and meet my wife in town to do, you know, human daytime things in the daytime. After which I then collapsed in bed, ready to then watch the Grand Prix in the middle of the night. So in one day, I think I slept and woke up on 5 separate occasions. And then once the Grand Prix stuff was all finished, tried to get a proper night's sleep. And my body just woke me up after 3 hours because my body was just going, well, that's what we do now. We sleep for 3 hours at a time. And so I'm sat here with a pint of coffee.
So you're just using stimulants to get through a day now?
Well, yes, I am. Because then my wife is away this week for like a music-y thing. And so don't worry about me. I'm the single parent. I'll do everything. My goodness, does this house miss her when she's gone? But then the main thing is like you have to be up, pack lunches, making sure they're dressed, not completely covered in cat hair, not in just completely the wrong either PE kit or uniform, depending on what they're meant to do. And so I've been forced then to get up. But I'm in a zombie state because to my body now, I feel like I'm up in the middle of the night.
I was off topic as always, but I remember many, many years ago, I was involved in drafting a legal highs protocol for a school.
Oh, this is good. Okay. Yeah.
And it was for staff, right? Because, you know, schools have policies. And there were two of us on there who had biomedical backgrounds. And we just pointed out because it said they're trying to, it was when all that stuff was in the news and people were trying to work out how to describe these things. Someone decided in writing it, and this may have been like quite wide usage language, but they said anything that causes a psychological shift. It was some wonderfully broad term, and we just said that means you can't have caffeine in your staff room anymore.
Riots.
let's just say what happened was the two scientists got told to shut up.
Yeah.
You and can't... the policy got through because it was like, I think it was standard for like loads of schools at the time. But it is wonderful that you have these things like caffeine that we all assume is, you know, just acceptable. But it has quite a significant effect on you. Certainly if you megadose caffeine, right, you can cause yourself huge heart issues.
I don't think a megadose. I probably have too much.
Do you get palpitations?
I have that the thing that I've told you about, that when I'm falling asleep, and I do struggle to fall asleep, then I can feel my heart and I don't like that I'm aware of my heartbeat, and then that can make it increase my heart rate.
Do you have that whilst drinking coffee and break out in a sweat?
I don't think so. I'm going to go out on it. I don't think coffee causes... What is a palpitation, though?
No. It's your heart starting to get... Basically, you can start interfering with heart rhythm with too much coffee.
I'm very suggestible, right? So if you say that, I'm now feeling like maybe I am having a palpitation right now. It's psychosomatic.
You'd probably know about it.
Oh, really? Okay. So there would be serious consequences. No, I don't think so. But on a normal day,
just getting through my normal day, I will definitely have three cups of coffee during the working day.
I think it also depends on the coffee you're having, right? If you go to like some Italian who has been working on his art for 50 years and can make the thickest, blackest coffee possible, that level of caffeine might be dangerous. Yeah. If you're using generic Tesco's,
I am on the
home brand instant coffee. Yeah. You're probably safe. There's probably no caffeine left in it after they freeze dry it.
I'm quite a posh instant coffee. Now, a lot of people will say there are no good instant coffees. Like, I disagree. I think there are some good ones. And but I used to really be into the Turkish coffees that you have in the, powder and the really thick ones. And those could, you know, keep your eyeballs open all night long. But in Italy, the coffee culture is completely different. So I was working on a joint British-Italian team for a while. They came over to see us absolutely disgusted with actually everything. They were disgusted with everything to do with the cafeteria and a coffee and going to a restaurant.
Did you take them to a greasy spoon?
we should have taken to a greasy spoon. No, that would have been like, here you go, here's British. And then when we went to Rome to visit them, we realised why. Of course they find everything disgusting. In their cafeteria, there's a chef like making the pizza in front of you, making this and it's not pizza like, you know, British pizza from the supermarket. It's this wonderful, thin, crispy, just delightful thing with flavours, and it's incredible. But all the meetings revolved around coffee and the espresso machine, and the breaks would be around the espresso machine. And if there was a queue for the espresso machine, that's a valid reason to be late for the meeting. And that's just not questioned. So, we thought it was an 8 o'clock. Yes, it was. But I saw Eduardo. We were at the coffee machine. There was a queue, so I had to wait. And you go, okay. That wouldn't go down in British culture at all.
Work-life balance. It's an idea.
They're good. They're so much better. Work-life balance. They spent so much time, you know, with things like their office was much more personalized. You know, one of them was growing radishes or something in his office. And he's like, oh, you must try my radish. I'm like, oh, okay. It's like plucking a radish. But yeah, it was really interesting culture shock. I would argue that we got more done in a day than they did, but maybe they seemed happier.
I mean, if you want science, and I'm risking someone writing going, that's an urban myth, but as far as I'm saying, coffee actually was very directly linked with the Enlightenment, because before then,
No. Everyone
went down the pub, and there was a lot of drinking, you know, quite watered down beer as far as I think it was, but a lot of beer drinking was what you did socially. And then they brought in coffee. And even in Britain, as much as we obsess over tea, coffee houses came a place where people would go and chat, and they were finally sober for enough time that they actually had some nice ideas.
So if you want a happy population that doesn't complain, you want to subsidize alcohol, then that's what Dr. Holding is calling for. The subsidising of alcohol, and he says for all ages as well. That's what Dr. Andrew Holding is saying.
I think you may have taken my suggestion that we drink coffee and stay sober in the opposite direction.
Yeah. But so I'm using it to stay awake. Firstly, it feels like it works. Like, this is not a placebo. I feel like I have the coffee, and if I don't have the coffee, I notice that I haven't had the coffee.
Yeah, but I mean, this goes, you know, if you're struggling with sleep, one of the bits of advice is to cut out caffeine, right? Because it really messes your sleep cycle up, because you can get addicted to caffeine. You can get, your body can be used to it. Not in a addicted and you can't control way, but you can get moody, you can get grumpy, you can, you know,
I'm
you
those
end
things.
Up needing it.
Yeah, so I'm dependent on it. Is there there's a difference between, I suppose, dependence and addiction?
This is one of those things where if I get enough people in the room, we can have a row about it, right? What is the correct definition? And people get quite annoyed and say, oh, my son's addicted to computer games. When actually what they mean is their son just isn't motivated to do anything else, right? They're not actually addicted. And I'm sure you had a phase when you were a kid, you get a new game and you just want to, you might hyper-focus on it for better than is healthy, but it didn't ruin your life, right? You moved on.
I don't know if that's true, if I moved on, because I do love a video game. I remember 1994, Super Bomberman on the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. And I played it so much that it's all I could think about. So I was in school and all I could think about was Super Bomberman Tactics. And to this day, I remain the greatest ever Super Bomberman player. And I will challenge anyone.
We'll get in a...
Bring your CRT TV and your Super Nintendo Entertainment System. Because I've tried emulating some of my favorite Super Nintendo games with the kids. and even the Nintendo Wii, we blow it up on a 50-inch LED screen and it looks like garbage. So you almost, oh no, I need to go and buy a worse TV to make this any good.
Yeah, but CRTs are amazing technology.
I think CRTs are fascinating, actually, because the fact that it sort of is drawing it one pixel at a time from the top corner, then along, then down one, and then along, and then it gets to the bottom, and that's one frame. That's some amazing tech.
And it's a mini particle accelerator. It's a mini CERN in your room. It's not something, like nowadays, it's just a light-up display. I mean, amazing technology in terms of semiconductors and all that. But a CRT, you had a particle accelerator firing, you know, more than 30 frames a second at your face. And you just be like, that's fine. I'd take it for granted. And you know, after the 70s, when you could actually leave it on without fearing it's going to catch fire at any moment. Because I don't know if you presume you have the same as me, but you had to turn them off at the wall because your parents were terrified.
Oh, yeah.
And they genuinely did, right? There were bits of electronics in there that in some of the cheaper TVs basically shorted out. They were capacitors that didn't light. You had to turn them off. So, yeah, we got to this point where we had these particle accelerators in our living room making TV. It's amazing.
And I actually love the science of it because it physically directed the particle to the part of the screen by using positive and negative charges.
And the particle is the electron. So the electron's wire is responding to, it's got negative charge response for positive or negative charge. I mean, it has to hit a dot on the front, which is either glows red, green, or blue, depending where it hits.
Yeah.
It's just brilliant.
It was hitting the particle, the pixel at a certain point that would tell it what color to be.
Yeah, so on a black and white TV, it's just the whole thing is covered in a material that glows white when it hits with electron. It basically was a tiny little hole just back from the screen, and depending if it goes straight, slightly to the left, slightly to the right, it hits red, green, or blue.
That is really interesting.
And it shifts that early on. So there's a whole mechanism to make sure it hits the right point.
So that makes so much sense of why it was black and white to start with, because it was either on or off.
Yeah. Basically, it's one color because there's no pixels. It just glows where electron hits. If you look at OLEDs, these organic light emitting devices, which are the really bright ones people really like, that every pixel there is almost a light in itself. Mm. So it glows because you put power into it, whereas, you know, before you were firing electrons at things. And what's really good about that is when it's off, it's completely black. So that's why people like those screens,
good,
have a really good
blacks.
Black. And a really...
Yeah.
Other things sort of happen, like you're saying how you like the picture of a CRT. It's because it blurs things quite a bit due to the way it works. It, over time, the phosphor takes time to, it glows for a bit, then fades away again. So you have sort of a time blurring as well. And of course, when people were making games for those screens, the artists were working on screens like that. So they designed the graphics for those screens. So when you put on a really nice crisp, I don't know, we've got a 75-inch OLED display.
I was about to ask.
Bomberman's going to look a bit ropey.
Yeah, so the original Mario Kart on Wii... That's not the original one. The original one was on Super Nintendo. Well, we did the Wii version on the 50-inch LED, and it looked like garbage. And the kids were like, really? This is what you played? I'm like, no, honestly. Right, we have to go and buy a rubbish TV. I was going to ask, though, what TV you have, because we have arguments about this in our house. Because my wife, who is the same age as me, but my wife is so old. Like, she's so old when it comes to tech. She just doesn't see the point. Like, she was upset that she had a 19-inch CRT at one point and thought that was too big and that we'd crossed the Rubicon at that point. And for years, she made me suffer with a 32-inch in the living room, when the standard now is like a 50-inch, isn't it, in your living room? Probably.
So we have a 50-inch in the living room, but the kids get a 32. They seem happy with it.
You're stingy. You're a stingy dad. Look at that.
There you go. But I was in a shop the other day and it like had a 75-inch, and I went to my friend like, who has the living room to fit this in? And his reply was, going by his survey of his relatives, people who really like watching snooker on low definition channels and just play it permanently. That was his survey of his relative family base, was basically no one who actually wants high resolution 5Ks using them. It's people who have a fixation with one sport and then even don't care about the quality.
All right, so we're talking about today, when do we become conscious? And I played the wrong button again. That's not the one I was trying to play, but at least you know who you're listening to now. It's
Cambridge 105 Radio.
I meant to do this one, like a cheeky little bed to say, all right, it's time to ask Dr. Andrew Holding, when do babies become conscious? And what is consciousness? Who am I? What am I? Am I?
So this follows on from a article written by some academics at the University of Birmingham to try and answer this question. And apparently, no one actually knows. That's the main thing.
Is it genuinely unknown? So there's no definition of when you become... Is it when you become self-aware?
Basically, for centuries, people have been like, you know, this is kind of an important thing. When do people become self-aware?
Yeah.
And, people sort of suggested, so the names in this article I'm reading are like Descartes, who's a famous philosopher from hundreds of years ago. He basically said, oh, people will have little thoughts that get bigger, right? That's the simple version of what he was saying. And people kind of went, kind of makes sense. We'll stick with that. So two academics have written in the Trends in Cognitive Sciences have suggested that maybe we could try and tackle this question. So they haven't actually got an answer.
Oh, so they've just said we should really sort this.
Yeah, and this is like a great part of science. We don't talk about it very often, where people just put forward ideas. So these often called letters or things like that, and they end up in these journals. And
I like that.
It's really hard, right? Because people don't actually know, like, how do you actually quantify consciousness? It's quite hard.
Yeah, all right. Well, that's not a very science answer. I demand answers. But I like the fact that they're sitting there just going, like, it's someone's job. Is it to think of things that we should be figuring out?
This is kind of things they'll be doing around their main research. It doesn't bring in the big science money, you know, do babies have consciousness? But what it does do is opens up new opportunities. And what they have said, so this is Professor Bremner and Dr. Taylor, is we should just use a really broad level of markers. Okay, so a lot of people use specific markers based on what are things that do with infancy, but they don't really know. So that kind of stuff sort of says it happens in the really, really early what consciousness. But they're thinking, just make it really wide and then work backwards from adults and try from there to see, well, when do they start disappearing? So maybe it'll look a bit different.
Can I be honest? I don't know if this is going to be one of those moments where I over-reveal something and it makes me seem bad. I don't think I have a genuine memory from before around the age of 9. Every memory I think I have that's like a core memory, if I look through the photo album of the limited photos I have from my childhood, every core memory I think I have is a photo. And I think all my early memories are just from photos, and then I've built a memory around them. But I don't think I remember anything from before the age of 9.
And childhood memory is a real...
Is it?
So I once sat down and asked someone, why don't we remember being a baby, right? So what this study's saying is, picking markers is quite hard because some don't appear till 3-4 age, where some appear really early developmental. And they're saying, actually, let's get more together and try and use a broad range of markers to work out what's early and late and build off that. And then maybe we can make a development of consciousness model. But what you're talking about is, you know, when do I remember being conscious?
And when did you remember being conscious?
I moved house enough times that I have memories of certain houses, so
point.
I know.
Yeah, but I did. I moved countries 3 times. No, 2 times. But I remember having a distinct conversation when I turned 10 and, like, talking to my friends in the playground of, like, isn't this weird? We've been around a decade. You know, that feels like a long period of time. And that's the first conscious memory I can summon of me kind of being aware that I'm alive. If you told me now that I was, you know, Halo style, I was just inserted into this world and existence at the age of 10, I'd believe you. I'd go, yeah, that tracks.
Well, one of the arguments for why you don't have memories at young age, but yours do seem to be particularly late, is that you can't relate to those very young memories. So the way your brain is working as a very young baby is very different from how your brain works as a toddler. So maybe you can't access those memories. Maybe they're there, but they're very different, or you just don't have them. And that's what my chatting to people who work on brains and brain development tell me.
It never got written. It just never got written, so there was nothing to remember.
But it, or they are there, and we just can't access them. It's just interesting, and I think that's really where these kind of studies, because we want to know, right? People like to know, when are you conscious? When you were, and how do we measure it? And I wouldn't be surprised if you'll find there are big differences between different children, how they develop. You're a parent, right? Your two children are incredibly different, I assume. Mine are, and
I definitely prefer one. over the other.
You're a terrible father.
Do you want me to say which one? Because you know what? Because the worst one will never bother listening to anything I do. He or she is terrible and doesn't take any interest. So only the favourite will hear it anyway.
Well, then you're just banking on.
Did I say he or she? I didn't specify a gender, did I? Because that would be a giveaway.
Mine are the same gender, so that's helpful. Don't have that risk. But yeah, so I think this is kind of a really interesting question. And it is just about, let's go and measure as many things as we can as markers and word backs and work out when they turn up and then try and filter down what is the key things that make consciousness. And we can work out why you have no memories before 9.
Also, let's not dig too deep. But there's also questions of like when you become a person. So isn't like 10 is the age where you have criminal responsibility for doing a bad thing?
I thought it was 11, but...
Is it? Okay.
Seems about right, right? It's around that ballpark.
Because I remember saying to the kids now, like, if you crime now, you'll end up going to, like, a juvenile thing. Like, you can't get away with things. You know, you're now at an age, believe it or not, you're in an age where you're considered responsible for your actions. Like, for example, if you were to pull the fire alarm at your school just out of curiosity because you had a compulsive, intrusive thought and you couldn't help but do it. Have I told this yet? Have I told you this?
I don't know this story. I know many of your compulsive thoughts. I had not heard about you.
It wasn't me. I got a phone call from the school. Hello, Mr. Reddy. I just want you to know everyone's okay. And I go, oh no, that's not good. Just so you know, before I start, I just want to tell you everyone's okay, but there's been an incident. And you go, oh. So we're seeing it funny now, right? The funny side of it now, and we tease my boy endlessly about it. But basically, he was stood waiting for a class, saw the big red button, and he just couldn't help it. And he just went, I'm going to press it. I'm going to see what happens. And he jammed it, just with his finger, jammed it. And apparently there's a thing in schools where the glass needs to be slightly less hard. So his little jab at it just broke the glass, fire alarm, emergency services contacted, entire school evacuated, and the nursery attached to the school. And so he caused absolute mayhem just from going, I want to press the button. I think... No, a part of him thought he would just be jabbing glass, but it broke and it set that all off. Why do we get to this? Oh, yeah. So apparently if the emergency services vehicles had turned up, you get charged like £1,000 for inappropriate call out, but they managed to get there in time.
So there we go. That's intrusive thoughts in young children.
Yeah, so he's not even that young. He's nearly 14. Nearly 14. But I was like, you are responsible for your actions now in the law. You've got to that kind of thing.
And it's more than that, right? I'm not an expert in the law by any means. But my understanding is if you also do something that you should be able to understand, you'll get tried as an adult.
Is it? I didn't know that.
Usually awful things you read in the press. But this is, I think there's a lot of law about whether you're a child or not, at what age.
So I've long thought, and I've argued this, because of my lack of memories before 9, I've always kind of thought, there's something that switches on that consciousness. And at some point you become like a proper person because you're aware of things. And I'm not sure that's present in like a 4-year-old or a 1-year-old.
And I think that's why I think the legal system is a good example, right? Because it's where actually practically comes in important. They have the decision whether you are capable of understanding the consequence of your action at age. So if you do something minor, or even quite significant, but you could never possibly understand the importance of that law.
Yeah, and you're 6.
Whereas if you do something that hurts another child, you should have understood that by 12, 13, that, you know, pushing your friend down the stairs is not okay. And if they break their leg, there will be culpability. And that's my understanding of how the law works from a very distant point of view. But it's interesting, the other thing you're talking about consciousness, you're saying something switches on. I think we've chatted about before, the internal monologue people have.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I was absolutely blown away when I discovered that not everyone has ability to image things in their head, including one of the people's like the lead artist behind The Little Mermaid or something, or the project lead in Disney. So these people in creative industries can't even visualize a circle.
So the visual one, I have that, the Anfantasia, and I think it's 1 in 50 people. So it's actually not even that rare. I can't bring an image into my head. If you say, imagine a red apple, I can't. And we only found that out about a year ago, that was a thing. So all the time, like in drama class, where it was like, close your eyes, imagine you're in a field and there's a tree and everything. And I'd be sitting there going, it's a bit lame. But everyone else is sitting there going, oh, I'm in a field. They've got their own personal VR headset just in their brain. And I didn't know that. So when people talk about a book bringing a page to life, it's literal. They can imagine the person. And that must be why some people get upset about film adaptations, because you go, well, I didn't imagine that Doris was like that, whereas I have no such, you know, preconception. So it's hard to get your head around it until I heard that some people don't have an internal voice. So they can't internally voice something. And I go, oh, that's like the sound equivalent of Anfantasia. So I kind of, that to me seems jarring. So now I see why people would find my visual thing jarring.
Yeah. And I find it really strange to think that you ever get any peace and quiet.
So you don't have an internal monologue?
I have an internal monologue. Right, yeah. And it's never quiet.
No, mine never stops. It's constant.
It's like, God, wouldn't it be nice to have a break sometimes?
To the point where you do wonder if there's almost a dual... I'm making myself sound mad here. But, you know, is there two parts of your brain? Is there like a...
I mean, just from pub talks, but I don't think these people are insane. So I think it's fair enough to say. You get people say, they literally go, why is my internal monologue so much smarter than I am? It's great to hear people go, like, they'll be doing something and we'll just hear themselves thinking, this is a really bad idea. Okay, why didn't I think of that before? And it's wonderful that so many people have different ways of interacting with their internal monologue. I don't think mine's ever sort of come out of inspiration, but it certainly debates any situation I've been in for the next 3 million years. In the shower, I won the argument, like so many people.
You know, in the movie scene where you have the, or even like Homer Simpson's internal monologue, which is like, come on, think. Like the classic Homer Simpson one is he's looking for a peanut under the sofa. And the brain is going, okay, look under the sofa, reach more. And he's disappointed because he only finds a $10 bill. And he goes, oh, I wanted a peanut. His internal monologue says, money is better than peanuts. Explain how. Money can be exchanged for goods and services. And there's that battle going on. But I actually have, I would say, closer to that. So when I'm in a situation, I have that internal monologue where it's a conversation through the activity that we're doing or to solve the problem. Like, and does that sound crazy?
No.
I'm internally talking to myself.
But I think it's amazing, this key part of life. Until scientists start putting these articles out where they actually research it, we all made assumptions about what other people thought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We all assume they have. And then you go, so not only is that normal, but for people who don't have that, that sounds just absolutely ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
And it's not until someone writes it down and says, you know what, this is a really common thing that, you know, you said 1 in 50 who can't imagine stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
that's quite common, isn't it? That's, you know.
And you know, it means something for education, right? When people say, oh, imagine this thing.
Yeah, they literally constantly do it. And I didn't know that they meant literally. And I'm actually, it's a bit gutting to find that out, that you're missing out on this area of life. But to someone who doesn't have an internal monologue, me talking about talking to myself must sound mad. That must sound crazy. But yeah, I've got like a little backer. It's a team effort in here.
Especially when, you know, certainly when I was a kid, people said, oh, if you're talking to yourself,
you're
crazy,
mad.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you're thinking, a large number of people in that room might not be doing it out loud, but they are. And this is what's great about science, is it's not just about making massive discoveries always. Sometimes it's about just realizing what's there already and learning about it.
So in Westworld, they play on this theme quite a lot, where the robots... become, you know, some of them are self-aware and some of them aren't. And there's a really interesting delineation point, I don't think it's too spoilery, where one of the main robots hears the creator's voice and instructions like, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. Oh, this is the boundary of the place. You will cause harm if you do this. And then at some point, it switches over where that inner voice is actually her own voice. And that was kind of the difference between... Oh, I got chills, actually. That was such a good scene. It's a really old series now.
You're allowed to spoil things. Yeah. It's past the statute of spoiler limitations. Yeah.
So I actually say that with the kids too. So both my kids, I know they have an internal monologue, but my boy is such a flight risk. When he was little, when it came to like curbs, constantly having to yell, stop! Stop! Don't run into... He was just determined to run out into every road. Train stations are just a nightmare. And so I was spoken to him about it, and he hears my voice when he gets to a curb. Yeah. So he hears the voice. And you know, when some people say, oh, whenever I do this, I can hear my dad telling me such and such a thing. But I said to the kids, I said, so you hear my voice for a lot of things and mum's and stuff. I said, well, maybe there comes a point where that voice becomes your voice. And that is kind of a marker of something, of the difference between discipline through fear and discipline through self-discipline.
Now you're talking about child psychology.
Oh, yeah, well, that counts as science.
It's important, though, but it isn't. Yeah. And in pedagogy and all these things, they're really, really important. I was just thinking, it's just the thing which I really remember about being a kid is, and maybe you have the same thing, is my parents, if they gave me a drink or a cup of anything, walking to put it down on the table or anywhere seemed like the most impossible task without spilling something.
I hate watching
it. Now, I'll walk to the canteen at work, make a cup of tea, walk around students queuing up for a lecture feed and I'd be like, I could never do this. And my parents used to be like, why are you so focus? And it's like, yeah, clearly I just needed to do it a lot. And then the nerves and the muscle memories, what terms for it, have now balanced. But I just realized the other day, I couldn't do this at all as a kid.
No. And as a parent, you've watched the evolution of what do you trust your kids to walk to the table with. So one time I gave my lad, and he must have been 7 already, and I gave him a bowl of pasta bolognese. And I saw him just idly kind of swinging it around on the way, like you might swing your keys. And then without looking, and then he just did it at an angle that the whole lump of pasta bolognese just slid out of the bowl onto the floor. And I watched it all unfold like in horror, like, no, surely he's not just going to tip the bowl to the point that, how badly do you have to complete that task for the pasta to fall out? And then you go, right, okay, then the first thing you do is trust them to take their dishes out after the meal, and then knives and forks just clang around all over the place. So there is you're not wrong. There's an evolution of being able to take stuff from one place to another place.
Life skills.
So when do kids become conscious? I think it's later than people think.
I think what they'll probably find is different metrics happen at different points, and that will be important to how we interact. Like, I think there's things you're still learning well into your teens, right? And okay, you're conscious, but they're still really important developmental milestones, and that's fine, right? We just let the kids do the things they're good at, and maybe don't let them run out into a road to find out the hard way that that's a bad idea.
Can we all agree though, that at 1, your 1-year-old doesn't know that it's having a birthday party? And that having a first birthday party is a complete waste of time and you just shouldn't do it.
I quite like cake, though.
Oh, yeah, that's a good excuse for cake. But that's what it should be. It's a celebration for the parents. So organise a time, invite your friends around, get a sitter, get a babysitter, send the kid to nursery, and then you celebrate having survived the first year of parenting, which is a massive shock to the system. Nothing on earth. I was just, how much money to have your kids again? Your current age now to have a baby now.
So I know my wife's a definite no. She's clear on that. I never want to be pregnant again, which I think most of us, having witnessed it, can understand.
Yeah. I can't. After the first one, I can't believe she ever wanted to have a baby again. I was really surprised. And then after the second one, she was now fully done.
Yeah, I think my issue is, I think I remember back to bits. I remember the good bits more than I remember the bad bits. And there are bits about babies quite nice. They stay still. They were generally quite cute. You just wipe them, clean them up. It seems so much simpler.
It does. Whereas now I have to, we've got preteen and teen each. We're having to deal with, I think I would say, my 12-year-old is conscious and self-aware. I'm not sure about the 14-year-old. So obviously it's different for different kids. Yeah, I think it's going to end up being a little bit later than people think. And it's that you have to sort of define what makes you self-aware and self-conscious. So, for example, don't they do mirror tests with animals?
Yeah, so most of the animal tests kids do quite well and quite early.
Oh, do they?
The other thing, though, is you find there's animals like crows are really good with tests for consciousness, which you wouldn't expect them to be because they have very small brains. And then there's bigger animals that don't seem to do it. And what I think comes out of that variation between different species, because birds are not in any way mammals, which is, despite that, they're all quite comfortable with them. It's not like they're some weird thing at the bottom of the ocean, but they are a different species. They evolved from dinosaurs down a completely different branch of evolution. the similarities of them being vertebrates, they're geared quite different in their brain. And maybe consciousness can take more than one form. And we don't know that. And I don't at the moment think crows are conscious, but if you go and look at the research for what crows can do, they're incredibly good at problem solving. They're very good at being self-aware. I think there was a recent one that went around on the web was a crow. They put something in a jar it couldn't get out of, so it was putting stones in the jar to lift the water level up, get the food.
Yeah, and you go, that one, yeah.
I know quite a lot of three-year-olds who struggle with that puzzle, right? It's not that crows are geniuses, though, in terms of the number of neurons in their head, so something else is going on there. Equally, visual challenges that birds are very, very good at. I regularly bring it up because when people are talking about artificial intelligence, and actually it was recently in the news to detecting breast cancer, about 5, maybe 8 years ago, a lab literally trained pigeons on how to detect breast cancer. And they had to peck on a button to say whether it was or wasn't breast cancer. And then they got great if they got the answer right. And they got trained. And because birds have really, really good vision, it worked. This has got no practical application because basically a large number of pigeons in a box diagnosing breast cancer is a large amount of looking after pigeons, feeding all the other stuff.
Yeah.
But from a psychology perspective and what they can do, it shows there's so much we take for granted, right? You would never be able to treat a three-year-old kid to do that. They wouldn't have the image processing ability. And AI, the reason why it's doing really, really well, is the maths behind the AI we have is very, very
brute
good
force.
At image processing.
Yeah.
So it's like giving pigeon grain.
Well, we're out of time. I've overshared once again. I'm a bit worried now that people are going to be concerned about why I have no childhood memories and why I talk to myself continuously. Feeling a little vulnerable right now, if I'm honest.
We'll go and get you a good psychologist.
No one psychoanalyze me. I don't want to know. Honestly, what am I, 43? I've only got to stick it out for, half a century tops, if I'm incredibly lucky. I'll just get by till then. But we do have lined up another clever person to talk to, which is Nicole Thomas. And so we'll get to that, but not before I tell you all to follow Dr. Holding by searching for Andrew Holding on Twitter. And for searching for Andrew Holding on Twitch, and you can watch him play a video game that I don't think I've ever said this to you, but you're not very good at that video game.
No, I'm not. We chat science and I play video games badly. That is the brand.
I joined you on that stream, but really ready to help you play this video game. And we played none of that video game over the course of 2 hours. But normally you have Matt on with you.
We did chat some great topics, though.
I can't remember any of it. All awash. Anyway, go and follow Dr. Andrew Holding, and we are going to go and talk science. Wrong button. I'm going to get it. It's two buttons. And that's all from a Dr. Holding. And now we go into the very serious world of grown-up scientists doing science on Earth, making our world a better place. And today we're going to be talking about community and public health approaches to dementia research. And I'm very pleased to have Nicole Thomas here to talk to us. Hello, Nicole.
Hello.
We love you people here on Cambridge Science, because whilst we're being silly and talking about giant space worms, you guys are out there making the world a better place. Tell us a little bit about your work around community and public health.
Well, we're certainly trying to make the world a better place. It can be quite frustrating sometimes. But essentially what we're trying to do in this project is start from scratch, really, because we've kind of realised over the last couple of decades that perhaps we've been doing things not as well as we could do. It means certain people in society are consistently missing from the conversations, and they don't necessarily have as loud a voice as they should have. And so even though we're kind of talking about dementia as the focus, essentially, you know, what we do in our lives and how we live our lives and where we live our lives can impact brain health. And those that might be less fortunate, they might be unhoused, they might be experiencing mental health issues, they're at higher risk of, you know, different things. And so we kind of really need to take a better, you know, community approach to understanding these problems.
So last week, I was talking to Dr. Joanna Anderson and really talking about how your mental health situation can affect your outcomes, you know, how stress can make you more susceptible to illnesses. And I think we don't really think about that in terms of demographics. So if you have a bit of a worse life, that is going to lead to sort of worse health outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the moment, we kind of still look at things separately. You know, you kind of got health issues and then you've got social issues. But actually, for some people in society, those two things massively interconnect. And we need to kind of bring those things together and start having a bit more joined up thinking when we're dealing with people that essentially, you know, are having a hard time accessing a GP, but also at the same time having a hard time accessing benefits to better their situation. And they are, you know, hugely linked.
And is that getting harder? Because without wanting to stray into politics, Britain just has less stuff now.
I think so. I think for me, I try to take a very much sort of a fairness-centred approach. So I try to see everybody's perspective in this. Everyone within the system is trying to do their best. But for some people, and, you know, healthcare professionals, academics, you know, people on, you know, on the street in community, they have better tools than others, or they, you know, they might have different tools, and all of those things make things work better or not. And I think that at the moment, we kind of need to get back to the sort of the relational things, the kind of the more human aspects of things, and how we can bring those two things together.
I think one of the key things you spoke about there early on is, you know, people who don't necessarily have a voice, and they're the people who need it. So as you stray into older age, and, you know, mental cognition can go down, specifically if you have a specific, you know, dementia condition, you know, who's specifically lobbying? You know, there's no company lobbying in Parliament, for example.
Well, this is, again, it's a tricky area, really, because the government did have a specific dementia care pathway plan. And then quite recently, they wanted to have a much broader just kind of health care pathway. So that means that people, you know, that with might be autistic, sort of dementia care pathways, all kinds of different, you know, mental health care pathways all get merged together. And so for years, people have been fighting for their individual experiences. And now it seems that they were listened to a certain extent, but now it's been all brought back together again. And it's very, very tricky. So where this project is quite complicated is that we're doing things from primary care, which is obviously all about sort of GP access, social care, which might be, you know, how you're accessing services within the community, and public health. So how we're assessing the public's health over a longer period of time. All of those things have their own individual agenda and needs, but we're trying to look at it from a very holistic approach. We're sort of trying to look at ourselves as academics as well, and kind of the processes that we have internally, the impact, health inequalities, the funders. You know, we're trying to look at every single level and how it all works together and how we can make it better, essentially.
So do you look into things like people's behaviours? So one of the funniest, it's not funny at all, but like married men live longer, but it's because they get told to go to the doctor. Like that is, there is a lot of truth to that. I would not go to the dentist if my wife didn't make me go to the dentist. So like even those kind of, you know, behavioural inputs, I guess, come into this.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we're kind of noticing within this project, and I think, you know, there might be other disciplines that this mirrors as well, is that authority now is kind of coming crossways. And so people aren't looking up to get more information and for authoritative figures to tell them what to do. They're looking to friends and family in their community. And I think it's to do with, you know, fake news and possibly the pandemic, you know, and kind of the conflicting information. And so there's just a huge amount of mistrust that now occurs. And when you have people that have been fighting the system for a very long period of time, for people, you know, that might be homeless or mental health issues, that, you know, that trust is even worse, if you like. So it all kind of impacts brain health, really.
It takes a long time to get anything done. So my brother is severely mentally handicapped. He's mid-30s, but, you know, he's got the mental age of they've assessed it as 4, but it doesn't translate exactly like that. But to get anything done, it's forms, phone calls, appointments.
Yes.
The bureaucracy must be, you know, a big, heavy part of it. But then you don't, there's this big perception that people are like desperate for benefit fraud money. But I think it's a relatively small proportion compared to, this is political again. What I'll do is I'll edit out me talking about politics and it'll just sound like it's you. But the bureaucracy around it almost feels morality driven, like they're the funding police. I know they've got to do it, but I don't. That's how it feels to me from someone, you know, from that kind of family.
Absolutely. So if we're kind of talking about brain health and we're talking about engaging with people, if we can take asylum seekers and refugees, for example. So those that we've spoken to within this project have talked about the quite traumatizing experience of coming into the country and being what they would class as interrogated by the Home Office in order to sort of find out what their intentions are and their motivations. And so that experience then, when we are as health researchers or even, you know, doctors, GPs, nurses, come with similar questions, they see it as a similar interrogative process, which is traumatizing. And so they don't want to engage with it. And part of that, you know, is forms. It feels to them like they are being tricked or it's being set up to fail in some way so they can't access it. And obviously that's not how health works, but that's their experience. And so we kind of have to change that.
I tell you from that community, so obviously we know a lot of families in the same boat, that is definitely that perception. And it feels like you're always having to kind of justify it. So what happens is you become disenfranchised from the system. So you become disenfranchised from the very people who are trying to help.
And I think that we can't keep expecting people to come to us just because we say that we are the authoritative figure. We have to reach out to them. We have to show that we're trustworthy. We have to show that we have particular values. How we do that, I don't quite know yet, but this is what all the project is about, is kind of unearthing these answers and solutions.
Okay, that was going to be my question. I was going to put you, I love hypothetically putting scientists in charge because scientists' voices just don't have enough weight, in my opinion. But I'm going to give you the keys. I'm going to put you in charge. Obviously, there are budget restraints, but are there any kind of, in your community and project, little things that you just go, I just wish X?
Absolutely. I think when it kind of comes back to bureaucracy, an efficient way of remunerating people that are involved. So we have to understand that people that are on benefits may not just simply want a Amazon voucher. It may not be appropriate. It may not be suitable for them. But there may be other ways that we can help them, you know, with food shopping or even just sitting down with them, offering an hour of our time, helping them fill out those forms. We kind of have to be a little bit more creative in making things more mutually equitable. And so I think that would be the one thing that if I could change now, it would be our internal systems to just create a more efficient way of collaborating with the community.
You know, people don't always want those vouchers. It's so humiliating. School dinner tickets, you know, where you had to get out your school dinner ticket instead of paying with cash. This is in the 90s. And like you hand over that. Sometimes I'd rather try to wait. So I'd be last. So no one would see that or just not eat. So yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about like food stamps, those vouchers, there's a big psychological thing in that where you go, oh, please just give them money. But if you give them money, they'll spend it on smokes is the rebuttal, isn't it?
And there's tax issues as well, you know, and also if they go over a certain amount of income, that means they're no longer able to get their benefits. But also what we've kind of learned within this project, which I find absolutely fascinating, is something that the community have kind of termed as toxic jealousy, where when you don't have an awful lot and you see your peers having something that you don't have. So, for example, our eligibility criteria might be age 50 and above. And you're 49 and you don't get the same kind of vouchers as that 50-year-old does because they're part of the project. That creates a huge amount of tension within that community. But then you also have others that feel guilty about taking something that others don't have. And so they won't engage with it because they don't want to have the money that others don't have. It's just so, I think we really do have to get into understanding what it's like on a human survival level when we come up with quite what we see as simple solutions as going, and we'll just give them a voucher to take part.
So how do you go about that research? Are you, you know, at ground level speaking to people on receiving ends of those schemes?
So what we're trying to do is something, it's a bit of a buzzword. It's called, you know, co-creation. Everyone kind of talks about co-creation, but we're trying to be really mindful of doing it well and doing it properly. So we don't want it to be tokenistic. We don't want to kind of stretch our ideas to fit. We want to be really quite honest and transparent in what we don't know and essentially put it to people that they are the experts and they need to teach us. we kind of come up with the ideas, we then go back to the communities and sort of get their feedback. And so it really is hopefully a real collaboration to find the solutions.
I've got an idea. You've got money, no object, but like have just like a buffet and go, come and hang out at our buffet thing, and then sneakily ask questions.
That's totally been one of the things. Like, sharing food is so important, and different cultures love to share their cultural food. And so that would be wonderful. I'd love to put on a huge banquet of just all different foods, different people, and just sit and share and break bread and learn about people.
Okay, it's my idea. I get an invite and okay, yeah. I get first dibs at any chicken. So any chicken legs, fried chicken. Thank you so much for your time. And I definitely hope we'll get you back. Is there anywhere that people can go and follow you and your work on social media and stuff?
We do have a Facebook page and Instagram, The Confad Project. You should be able to search it up and find us.
Yeah, you're going to have to spell it for me. You can't just say a word, I've never heard
sorry.
Before.
Of course. It's C-O-M-P-H-A-D.
I'm going to go and look that up on Instagram and Facebook right now. Nicole Thomas, I hope we'll have you back, but thank you so much for your time.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
And that was C-O-M-P-H-A-D. Go and check that stuff out. Thank you for joining us on Cambridge Science. Good fun, I suppose. Learned some things. It's a lie, I learned nothing. See you next week. This is Cambridge 105 Radio.